I'm Tammy Vindunch, your host for Executive with a Cause. Today on the show, I welcome Chris Heatherly, the CEO of the Academy of Social Sciences. Today, we're going to chat about the good, bad, and hard things about running a not-for-profit. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tammy. It's delightful to be here.
We met last year when a previous podcast guest, Kate Luke from the Little Oak Sanctuary, had introduced us. I guess she worked for you for a time. Is that right? Or you worked together?
She did. Yeah, that's right. And looking back through the episodes, I'm a subscriber now, but I've actually worked with a number of your guests over the years. So it's a small community here in Canberra, not-for-profit world, but it's nice to have been put in touch.
Yeah, well, I think not-for-profits in general in this country are a small world, and that happens so regularly. It's not uncommon for people to tell me that when they see the previous guest. For those people that are not familiar with your organization, can you please tell us more about the Academy of Social Sciences?
Sure. So the Academy of Social Sciences is one of five so-called learned academies in Australia. Not entirely sure what makes them learned, but they've been around for a good long while. So our organization just had its 50th anniversary year before last, 2021. And there are academies that represent the sciences. So the Academy of Science in Australia is perhaps the biggest and best known. They've got a fantastic building here in Canberra, the Shine Dome, that many locals will know about at least. But there are also academies that cover the technology and engineering sciences, health and medical sciences, and the humanities and arts. So these organisations, and the Academy of Social Sciences covers, you know, everything from economics and anthropology through to history, law, psychology, etc. But they're basically a membership organisation of leading academics for the most part, some, you know, high-profile public policy people, or in our case we've got, you know, Supreme Court retired judges or politicians as well as members. But people have to be elected into these organisations. So they're fairly exclusive kind of clubs, if you like. And the roots actually go right back to the Royal Society of London, which was formed, you know, 350 years ago by Isaac Newton and co, as these kind of bodies of esteemed thinkers and commentators and scholars of the day. So our Academy of Social Sciences, we've got about 750 members across Australia. They're all elected through a very competitive process, about 20 a year, and we do a range of different things, provide advice, expert advice to governments, both the federal government here as well as state and territory governments, to business groups. We have grants programs. We engage internationally with similar bodies, both in the Indo-Pacific region but also globally. And we're increasingly trying to reach out and engage with the public as well, you know, going from being an introverted kind of organisation in a bubble to a more public-facing organisation that's a bit more relevant to the modern society.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think the word academy, I get two thoughts in my mind when I hear that. It's either one, it's like some sort of a school system of sorts where maybe there's certification programs, I guess, in your industry. And then the other, you think about like the Academy of Awards for, you know, in Hollywood, where the peers elect who's going to win the next Oscar. So it's interesting that this term, which I don't think is as common in other countries, maybe the Commonwealth, but not in some of the other countries, how it's used in this environment. Given that everyone's elected, how many people apply every year?
So it's a good question. There's a nomination process. So usually anywhere from 40 to 70 or 80 people are nominated each year, but they've got to be nominated by members. So, you know, the Film Academy in the States is probably the best analogy, actually. You know, we're not as glamorous, perhaps, and our awards aren't quite as, you know, red carpet, but it's a group of members who nominate others in their fields to join, and then there's an election process of members. So it's, you've got to know the right people, basically, to get nominated in the first place. So it's not something that anyone can just rock up and apply to.
Okay. And then how are you funded, then?
So that's another good question, where we do get a fair portion of our funding from government, either as part of a block grant, which is, you know, for those not familiar with it, there used to be thousands of block grant funded not-for-profits in Australia, but that's been whittled down over the years through competitive processes and outsourcing. And, you know, we're possibly one of the last few kind of categories of organisation with legislated block funding left. But we also do a lot of commissioned work. We're all philanthropic organisations, DGR status, that's gift recipient status, so people can make charitable donations, tax-deductible donations to the organisations. Our members all pay a fee. We engage in partnerships with different organisations domestically and internationally. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, as most not-for-profits are, I guess.
Yeah. And do you see that funding changing much over time?
Always trying to diversify as much as possible and wean off government grants, because it's lovely to have, but unpredictable and subject to change at the whim of a minister. So trying to diversify as much as possible, including through financial investments and things for the small reserves we do have.
Okay. Well, before we get too far into the operations of the organization, I'd love to know a little bit more about you, Chris. How did you get involved in the not-for-profit sector?
Well, thanks, Tammy. I like many people, went through school, didn't quite know what I wanted to do, spent a few years traveling around the world on a push bike, actually. That was my late teens, early 20s thing. And then eventually found my way back to university, kind of followed my partner, now wife, into psychology and got a psychology degree, kept on going with it right through to a PhD in the end. I didn't want to go into clinical work, though. I did dabble with the public service, the federal bureaucracy. I had a graduate position, but I left after a few months. It wasn't for me, the kind of processes and just the bureaucracy. And I was lucky enough to get a job with Alzheimer's Australia, the national peak body for dementia in Australia, in a program management role. And that just clicked. I loved the culture, the environment, the nimbleness of a small organisation, being able to do positive things without having to go through layers of management and approvals and without having mounds of paperwork. I'm kind of allergic to policies and procedures. I know they're important, but then from there, after 5 or 6 years and being involved with some fantastic kind of lobbying campaigns that really mobilised the whole country around dementia funding and dementia awareness, I got into science. I went to work for the Academy of Science that I mentioned previously, and I was there in a kind of director of policy and government relations for 5 or 6 years, and then into my current job with the Academy of Social Sciences in a CEO role.
So. Yeah, okay. Well, so you've seen a number of organizations through time, and although they've all, except for probably the organization involving dementia, they have this very strong science base, and funding is probably kind of similar from that. What are some of the similarities and differences that you've seen across the not-for-profits you've worked with?
I've got three examples, and they've been similar in many ways, different sizes and scales. So the organisation I'm with now, we've got 9 staff, mostly part-time. The Academy of Science, where I worked previously, we had 60-odd people. I had 15-odd people working for me in my team. So, there's a scale difference. There are some not-for-profits that are much larger, again, into the hundreds, particularly service delivery kind of organisations, and there are some tiny ones. So I've kind of always been in that middle range. And all of them have kind of, there's the challenge, which I love to try and think of as an opportunity and as a thrilling ride of trying to do everything with a small number of people and low resources and having to be across, regulation and budgeting and finance, right down through to the engagement, stakeholders, IT systems, strategy, program development, delivery. So there's the kind of need for everyone to be a generalist in some ways and to draw on specialists as required, either as consultants or as members. You mentioned the science space, that higher education space. That's particularly someone who kind of did an apprenticeship as a scientist, if you like. I did the PhD and then chose not to go on with the research career. I've actually really appreciated being able to work at the interface between research and that kind of academic world, and then the public policy and program space, and almost acting like a broker in a way. Knowledge broker is a bit pretentious for me, but in some ways that's what it is. It's trying to interface between the experts who are at the cutting edge of the research world and the public policy people who are trying to put things into practice.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to think about the organization itself. So many of the membership associations, I work with quite a few as clients, they're really, really focused on the members, but a lot of it is to professionalize the industry. That's a lot of their goals. And I think that's a common theme. In this case, you already have people that are like experts in their space. They don't need certifications. They don't need probably the acknowledgement, although this probably helps. How's it like working with these stakeholders? Because these are individuals already recognized for what they do. They don't actually need your help to progress in their careers. So when you talk about being a broker, how does that actually work for them? Because in another association, I would see them being a broker, like helping them with their careers and such. But in this case, these people are already the experts in their careers.
Yeah, again, it's a really good question, Tammy. I mean, we're in a position where we can act, we are a membership organization, but we can act more like a peak body and focus exclusively on being that peak body, because we're not kind of tied up in all of that professional development, career development, credentialing kind of stuff that many other membership organizations are. And the organization I'm with and the others I mentioned before, they were formed by these members for a purpose. So the purpose was really to try and create umbrella organizations through which they could come together to influence policy outcomes or international outcomes, or to influence the shape and direction of their fields and disciplines. So that's kind of the origins, and we are able to do that by bringing people together. So it's kind of coordinating expertise across the members. They all do this individually in their own right, you know, everyone. And because, you know, many of our members are current or former secretaries of federal departments, or they're heads of universities or big departments or schools at universities in many cases, you know, they're well-versed in talking to decision makers and kind of having a seat at the table, and they can do that individually, and they do that individually, but there are issues and times where it's more beneficial for them to be able to do that collectively through an independent organisation rather than through their, you know, university hierarchy, say, or whatever. So that's really the value. One of the challenges that it presents, and again, this I think is probably different from other membership organisations, is it really partly historical and partly by virtue of the nature of the members. We have a kind of a different power relationship between the management and the members than would be the case, I imagine, in many other membership organisations. So I'm the CEO, but, you know, I'm working with members who are far more senior than me in terms of their own experience and careers and positions. For a long time, we're a national office now, but for a long time it was a secretariat, and that was how it was conceived and framed. And the person in my position was the secretary, so it was kind of providing services to this, you know, high-profile membership. And it's kind of readjusting and rebalancing that to show now that our national office and the professional staff are actually adding a huge amount of value, not just taking the minutes and organising people's flights and things. So it's been interesting.
Yeah, it would be a very interesting transition. I could picture how that power dynamics is when, like you said, these people are in, are used to being in charge, and so they have a CEO that they may not always enjoy those rules. And I'd also imagine that you'd probably, even on the policy perspective, you would not always have a consensus of decision in terms of how to promote a certain policy, a certain direction for government with so many, you know, different people in the room. Can you give an example of like a policy that they might have influenced recently? Like, I don't know if there's anything that's currently relevant.
I mean, there's lots of work going on at the moment. So in our policy work, we kind of have two portfolios, if you like. One is about research policy and higher education policy, and trying to influence, you know, the funding structures and the supports and the career pathways that let our members and their colleagues and students and, you know, employees do their own work and have their own careers. So that's that kind of the research policy stuff. And there's an enormous amount going on at the moment. The new government in Australia, elected last year, is reviewing everything, basically. It's all on the table, and there's just, you know, reviews after reviews. So there's lots of opportunities to get engaged there. New government, they're listening as well. You know, we kind of felt ignored for a lot of the last 6 or 7 years, but it's really motivating and energising to be kind of at the table in those discussions. We also, you know, do a lot of work on public policy issues, so climate change or... Yeah. Youth unemployment or, you know, substance use harms, immigration, you know, the list goes on. There's a huge amount of stuff there. And we can't do everything. We have 750 members, but only 9 staff and 2 people in a policy team. So yeah. We have to be selective and creative as well. We, you know, try and draw on interns and secondments and all kinds of things to research some of the work we're trying to do. Yeah. In terms of examples of, well, it's hard to attribute success sometimes. Being at the table and having discussions with the right people can be perhaps the most influential sometimes. We have done a fair bit of work on climate change over the last few years and climate policy in particular. You know, in Australia, local listeners will know this, international people might have heard about it too, but the Australian government screwed up royally on carbon pricing 10 or 12 years ago. It was almost there, and then there were a few missteps and it just fell apart, and it put our climate policy in this country back by a decade. So it's only really now coming full circle again to the point where there's opportunities to look at some reform. And it's not top priority in the current government's agenda, but there have been commitments made to reducing greenhouse gas emissions over a much more aggressive time period than we had previously. How to do that? That's kind of the real policy question. And we've been able to get some of our members, our really senior economist members who are expert in these fields on economic policy and incentives and behavioural kind of nudges, how you kind of encourage and incentivise people to do certain things in a policy sense. We've been able to get them in the room with the decision makers to basically share that expertise in a safe space where nothing's going to get tweeted or, broadcast to the media, and they're not going to get bashed over the head if they do or don't act on the advice. So I guess it's hard to pin down any concrete big wins, but there's lots of those smaller kind of backroom discussions which lead to influence, which is kind of where our efforts are at the moment.
I don't think you can underestimate the value of those behind-the-scenes conversations with the legislatures, right? That I think a lot of people think you hire lobbyists and they go in there and they knock on the door until they finally open it, and then they shove this piece of policy down their throats, and then they'll do something with it. But that's not really how it works, is it? There's a lot of time spent in building relationships and having ongoing conversations over time to help make changes. So
that's right, trusted relationships. And in a previous role, one of the Science Academy organisation I worked with, we spent a lot of time trying to get meetings with government ministers and other elected representatives, and we lined up a big series of meet and greets. And, it was seen as a really important step. But one thing that anecdotally that stuck in my mind is having a meeting with a government backbencher, who was interested, very polite, and talked to him for half an hour before the bell went off and he had to go and vote on something. And then sitting next to the same person at a dinner 3 weeks later, and he had no recollection of the meeting at all. He couldn't remember, and so he was a bit embarrassed about it. But then he explained, since I saw you 3 weeks ago, I've seen 60 other groups come through the door. I've had 15 other meetings with my, government colleagues. Thousands of pages come across my desk, and, I'm sure I enjoyed the conversation, but sorry, it's just you need more than one meeting.
Yeah, and how do you select who those people are? Because you just mentioned you pretty much were knocking on a lot of different doors. I'm sure that there's probably a better way to do that than to knock on every door.
Yeah, it comes down to resources. I mean, the more the better in some ways, but being a bit more selective. When you get to the level of ministers, there's portfolio responsibilities, so people are going to be interested in, obviously, in the things they're having to deal with, the questions they're having to deal with legislatively or in a policy sense. So that's one obvious point of connection. More generally, though, going to speak to people, anything we found over time, anything we do to relate it to their own electorates, their own, constituents was really helpful. So, we're developing school education programs now, and one of the strategies is to, as we expand the number of schools we're working with, to go off and talk to the representatives for those regions and try and organise an opportunity for them to see something in action in their local school with their local constituents. And they'll love to do that. It's a photo opportunity, but it also helps to get them engaged and as a champion. And even if they don't have policy responsibility, if you've got champions, people who know you and trust you and you've done a favour for, in a sense, they can help through the back channels within the corridors of power sometimes as well.
Yeah, I think there's some great advice there. Whether they're working with the state or local council versus the federal government, any not-for-profit that is needing to build those relationships. So most do need some of that. I think there's some good advice in there. Now, when we originally met, Kate had introduced us, and you had come back to me because of what I do for a living, which is help not-for-profits with their IT strategy. And we were talking about Salesforce. And we had a quick conversation on the phone, but we were largely talking about how you used it. And I was really interested in how you're using it for grant management, because it's not really built for that purpose, but you were able to make it work that way. First of all, can we talk about, I hope you don't mind us getting into the tech a little bit, can we talk about your Salesforce implementation? Because you don't see it used very often in membership organizations because it's not really built for purpose, but you guys have chosen that system and are currently using it.
Yeah, so I'd had some experience with a Salesforce implementation at the Academy of Science, my previous employer. In fact, that's where I met one of your previous guests, Heidi Prowse,
who was
helping on that project as well. There are a few things that appealed about Salesforce to solve some of the problems we had. It wasn't just grants management either. It was a membership database more generally, and you know, moving from an archaic system where data was buried in a website and member profiles and the like that needed to be exported and turned into something that could interface with other platforms and the like as well. So Salesforce appealed, A, because I had a bit of experience, B, because of the charity licensing, you know, to tell the truth, all the other systems were expensive. The less than 10 employee licenses as a charitable donation from Salesforce.org basically meant we could get started at zero cost with a bit of internal training, a bit of internal know-how, some casual support to help with the data migration and cleaning. Let us get started in a context where there was no budget. I'd just started in the role at the time, and it was there was an IT disaster that was presented to me. Our system's not working. We've got this old falling apart physical server, you know, 8-year-old desktop computers that that are unreliable. What do we do? And in a way, I was actually fortunate to have started on all of that before the pandemic, because we got a head start on everyone else having to do it at a moment's notice when people could no longer turn up to the office. But Salesforce appealed, I guess, for those reasons, because it was so customizable. You know, the first thing we needed to do is to, as I said, to move all the member data primarily from the web, from an old website into a platform, and then link that platform back to a new website, and you know, to basically create an active searchable directory of our members with the information all in a single spot. And that was really the principle, and it has been ever since. Is, you know, this isn't news to anyone, but the purpose of a CMS or a stakeholder relationship management system, we chose deliberately to call it rather than customers, because we don't
have customers.
Stuff. It was to really get all of our stakeholder information to a single spot, so that we didn't have duplication, we didn't have separate spreadsheets flying around in all different corners, we didn't have people, you know, there were some terrible examples of our members, they're elected and they're usually members for life, so we have people who pass away, and one person in the organisation being informed and noting that on their spreadsheet, and then the next week another person sending them an invoice for membership, and the poor bereaved spouse, you know, saying, I've just told you this. Yeah. So that those terrible and avoidable kind of consequences of not having an integrated system for data we were trying to solve initially. So getting the thing set up, the Salesforce.org, getting it integrated, connected to the WordPress website, that was another challenge which we solved. It was a little bit more complicated than I expected, but we did it through a plugin. And then we started looking at some of our business processes, really, and grants management was one of them, but that's actually come quite a long way down the track. The first thing we needed to solve was the very complicated election system we have for membership, so whereby members are nominated, first of all. They have to be nominated by 3 existing members. Mm-hmm. Those nominations go through a multi-stage voting process. There's assessment externally that has to be lodged in the system. And then there's a kind of 2-stage ballot of members, all of which was done by paper before, plus a couple of IT systems which had been trialed and had backfired spectacularly. So we decided to try and build this all into Salesforce, so the information would all be there. We'd, you know, have continuity over time. People could be re-nominated without having to start from scratch. And so that our members could log into a single place and, you know, update their details, pay their membership, vote. Only one password for people to remember rather than multiple platforms. And we've done that through the Salesforce Communities platform. So we have community licenses, which not a huge number of members, but it gives us basically a member portal. It gives us a guest portal for people who are coming in for some of our grant programs from outside our membership. And over time, we've managed to build the grants program and look at some other integrations with our finance system, for instance. And our next on the list is our mailing system and then our filing system through Microsoft SharePoint. So that's kind of the process. It hasn't been smooth. I mean, medium-sized not-for-profit with an annual turnover about, you know, $1.5 million. The first vendors I spoke to, once we'd signed up for this free Salesforce and got it running, were quoting us, you know, a third to a half of our annual revenue to do the development work we needed, which is probably fair enough, but it was completely out of scope, you know, for what we had. And when we tried to suggest lower figures, they'd no longer be interested in talking to us, right? And there was just so much work, particularly in Australia. I'm not sure if it's the same overseas, but the Salesforce vendors and, you know, the companies in that space, they've got plenty of work to do. There's no shortage of work, and there's a scarcity of people who have the skills. So we found our way to an overseas developer in India, which was affordable, but very challenging in terms of the language barriers, the communication timeliness, some of the skills as well. You know, a lot of the initial stuff we had developed was developed in a very static way, which worked once for the problems we were facing, but was going to cause all kinds of troubles once we tried to repeat these processes. You know, there were fixed objects with no scalability and all kinds of issues. So we kind of muddled our way through and made it through the first year, but then realized pretty quickly we needed to find a better solution. And again, it wasn't easy, but we found a local developer who works for one of the bigger companies, not directly in that space, but who was very happy to do some freelance work on the side in evenings and weekends. And we've been working with this guy now for 18 months with a kind of a development roadmap. And it's going pretty well. Just now, after 3 years down the track, we are starting to think about getting somebody else in to do more of an architecture review, and just to cross-check that we're operating as efficiently and as effectively with this whole system and all the integrations as we can, and have a look at some of the changes coming on down the track with privacy legislation, et cetera, and just to try and map out what the next 3 to 5 years might look like as well.
It's such an interesting system, I think, for not-for-profits in general. It didn't matter if you're a charity or a membership organization. And in fact, I spoke to one yesterday, which is a membership organization that is using Salesforce and is thinking about pulling it out and replacing it with something that's already fit for purpose because they have so many plugins going into the system at the moment. Salesforce, though, for you guys to be able to get where you were with such limited help and budget, I imagine that even you personally got heavily into the deep end of the Trailhead Learning Center to just learn about how to program some of the stuff yourself. I mean, this is not, because it's so customizable, it's not something that you can kind of half-heartedly do.
No, and I mean, we cut a lot of corners and took a lot of shortcuts and probably, you know, if we had $1 million to work with a vendor over a couple of years, we would have a much more polished system and we wouldn't have had some of the mistakes and frustrations for ourselves and for members that we had along the way. But we have got to a good spot now and it's working pretty well. And I mean, I actually enjoy that kind of stuff. I do enjoy geeking out and getting into the code sometimes. It's probably not a super great use of my time because I'm not very good at it, but I don't mind it as a diversion. It has helped. You know, I've kind of got an understanding of the system. And in the past we had, you know, you spoke to Kate. She was we put her through admin training and another colleague in a similar position. We don't have anyone in that role now, so it's potentially a bit of a gap. Just the way things work with a small team of 8 or 9 people, you know, we kind of go with the people you have and the skills and the interests they have at the time. So maybe down the track that's something we'll look to solve with an in-house administrator, but so far so good.
Yeah. Well, certainly the fact that you've used it for so many different things, you know, certainly that election process, as you said, it's very complex to design that so it continuously works. But also grant management, I've always found people that try to use Dynamics, but each grant is designed so differently that for them to manage it requires a whole new configuration for the next grant.
And I think if we'd started with grants, it might have been a different prospect. I mean, there are lots of good grant management platforms out there which work really well. I've used and worked with some of them before, but there was nothing out there that would solve our election process issues. So regardless of what we chose, we're going to have to develop from scratch.
Yeah.
And that probably influenced the decision around Salesforce as well.
Well, I think for people that are questioning whether or not Salesforce might be a possible CRM for them in the future, just to know that you've been able to pull it off and with a small team and just some minor help, then I think that's probably encouraging for them as well.
And I'm not across the detail, but my understanding is all of these things evolve and they're continually improving their products. But some of the new functionality coming down the line with Salesforce in things like flows is going to make it even easier down the track. We'll still need some customization and custom code, but you know, there'll be a lot of the core of these processes will be kind of almost drag and drop visual designing, which you know, non-developers should be able to do, as far as I understand it anyway.
Yeah. But then once again, you have the architecture issue, and if you're building it piecemeal, then sometimes you lose sight of the ultimate goals, and you do make it harder. So it is an interesting challenge, you know, when you're limited on budget and resources, but you have these needs. How do you do it? I don't think it'd be possible unless you actually got involved heavily, like you have, though.
Yeah, either myself or somebody else on staff who can kind of see a process through. Otherwise, you're paying a vendor and a kind of a contract manager to do that job, which is you know, equally valid. And in another situation, you know, a board might have decided to make that investment, and it's probably an investment that a lot of organizations would need to think about seriously. So
I think all good pieces of advice for someone else who's considering a CRM right now. So thank you for that. I'm just conscious that we'll probably be running out of time sooner rather than later, but I wanted to talk more about how you actually engage your community. Are you using Salesforce? You said that you were looking at using some sort of mail other platform. I mean, anyone that uses Salesforce will know that the Marketing Cloud is incredibly expensive if you choose to use it. So what are you using right now?
So we're using a mailing platform. ActiveCampaign is the product. As our mailer, we do use the built-in mailing tools from Salesforce for specific purposes, particularly when we need to segment lists and have, you know, specific communications that go out. And many of our processes now that have been built into Salesforce with the elections, the membership invoicing as well, we've connected that through to
our
finance system.
Is that Pardo? Are you using Pardo?
No, just the built-in
mailer. Just the basic one. Yeah. Okay, all right.
And that, you know, with some custom HTML templates, and that works really really effectively, especially the automated messages. Get around the from email address, so it lands in people's inboxes rather than their junk folders. Mm-hmm. We do use it for engagement, but not perhaps as fully as it was designed for and as a sales company would, for instance. So we don't log everything in through Salesforce. We don't send everything. We do log all the important communications through Outlook plugins and the like, but you know, most of our communication externally is through other channels rather than Salesforce. It kind of sits more in the back end.
Yeah, okay. Do you use SMS?
No, we don't.
No. Is that also, I know a lot of membership organizations struggle with the demographic changes, where they have a group of people that would rather call you up and talk to you, and then you have a younger generation coming through that just wants to do everything themselves and get an SMS. Yeah. Do you have that difference in demographics with your
Not as much. I mean, we just by nature of the level of career people have had to get to become elected in the first place, and then they're members for maybe 30 years after that. So it's an older demographic. Some of whom still, you know, don't have email, but we do a little bit of paper stuff still, and email's a happy medium for almost everyone. We haven't gone down SMS path yet.
Yeah, okay. So what are the challenges that you're seeing in the next, say, 12 to 18 months for your organization?
I mean, I think the last couple of years have changed things for everyone. Keeping a focus on strategy, I guess that's a more general concern, but in a small organisation, it's so easy to get buried in projects and sometimes the governments, you know, board members, voluntary boards. We've got a voluntary board as well, who are very smart people, but they haven't been trained in governance. They're not professional directors. So that kind of distinction between governance and management is pretty blurry sometimes. And sometimes that's great. Sometimes it's frustrating. but trying to make sure there's opportunities to keep a strategic focus and actually, as you say, you know, look at what's happening over the next 6 to 12 months. You know, where do we want to be? Where do we want to be in 3 years' time, 5 years' time? You know, lucky we've got a very good strategic plan, a single page with five kind of pillars of core activity, and we've been able to structure everything around those five pillars. So budgets, staffing, annual reports, meetings, you know, so everyone's got a copy of this thing on their wall, and I try and encourage everyone to look at it every day and just remind themselves of where they fit in the strategy and where their work fits in the strategy. And because the whole organisation is structured around that strategy now, that's kind of, that was a transformation as well, but that was useful. I think perhaps you know, we're pretty well placed at the moment, but workforce is a challenge. You know, it's talking to other colleagues who are trying to recruit for various roles. It's extraordinarily challenging at the moment. So retaining staff is probably the key thing, and providing that kind of flexibility that people have come to expect, and kind of letting go of the management reins a little and trusting people to be able to deliver on what they need to deliver, even if they're, you know, not logging on from 9 to 5 like they used to, and letting people have a bit more work-life balance and time with their families and kids. And, you know, I was talking to a colleague in another organisation the other day who's just introduced an uncapped annual leave system. You know, it's, everyone's heard of this, I'm sure, you know, the renegade IT companies in the States who are doing this, but introducing that into a not-for-profit context, you know, so bit blown away, and I floated it with my staff as well, and they were a bit blown away as well. You know, how would that work? What would it mean? You know, we no longer have 4 weeks annual leave. We have as much as we want, but can we take any at all? So we're not kind of moving there yet, but there's all of these kinds of things which I think need to be thinking about, because that's where everything's moving, and for not-for-profit to compete for really good staff, and most, you know, for everyone on this who's listening, I'm sure, you know, the staff who work for not-for-profits are there because they want to make a difference as opposed to career aspirations or financial goals, but still do have to compete. Everything's getting more expensive. People are making decisions about how much they work and where they work to get the most money they can for the best balance they can achieve. And I think it is hard for not-for-profits in some ways, but easier in other ways too.
Yeah, I certainly saw that when I was a CEO, and you'd hate to lose a good staff member to like the public service because they're paying double what they were getting for us. But at the same time, you do get a lot of great people there that just come for the heart. And if they could financially afford to work for you, they will. That's probably the question. I'll be curious to see how it goes with that unlimited leave for that one organization.
Yeah, well, we're not going to take that step, but for the other organization, maybe I'll introduce you to my colleague and you talk to her.
Yeah,
about
please.
It.
I'd love to have a chat with her. It's interesting from a performance management perspective too, right? I published yesterday in my weekly newsletter on LinkedIn this article that was talking about even performance management is so difficult when you don't see people anymore, and when you had a single manager providing that feedback on a quarterly, semi-annual basis. Now it's like you don't see them on a daily basis, and their interactions are more likely to be flat. So trying to create a performance management structure that actually makes sense with the people they interact with, not just their boss who never sees them anymore. I think, yeah, there's a lot of changes happening to most organizations, and that's not just not-for-profits for sure. Interesting. Okay. Now, Chris, you've been in a few organizations now. You've seen a lot of things. You've obviously gone through both the organizational and IT transformations. Anything you want to share as far as lessons learned with other executives that may be in similar positions?
I suppose everyone's facing so many different things and trying to do the trap I've always fallen into is trying to do too many things and trying to do too much at once to the detriment of everything sometimes. But But I think probably the most useful thing for me had been getting that strategy down pat, 3-year strategies, not longer, with a really clear vision of what it is to achieve. I had a great board member who helped me develop the first of these, and he said, if it doesn't fit on a page, it's too long. It needs to fit on a page. You need to have a clear view over 3 years of what you're going to do, and it has to fit on a page. So that was useful. You know, making mistakes is positive. It's cliched in a way, but kind of going out on a limb, especially in a not-for-profit where you're trying to do things on a shoestring perhaps, or trying to take some shortcuts, you know, mistakes happen. People are usually pretty understanding. And the important thing, obviously, is to learn from them, treating them as opportunities. You know, there's, again, it's the stuff you read in all the books, but that's been useful. Getting a bit of a peer network together, because, you know, the bad days can be pretty bad. And as an executive, often there's no one to kind of go and have a drink with and and share your worries or just vent. You know, family's great. My wife's very sympathetic and understanding, but also has enough on her own plate that she doesn't necessarily want to hear about my crappy day all the time. So a bit of a peer network has been really helpful, and actually putting time and effort into cultivating that. But I mean, I don't know, these are all the general kind of management things that everyone develops in their own way, right?
Oh, they do. But I think, you know, if someone's listening to this and they get just one little piece of nugget that they can take away and say, oh, I hadn't thought about doing that, or doing it that way, or maybe you've turned them on to another person, perhaps, I think then they'll probably say it's worth their time to hear this conversation. Chris, thank you for your time today. Thank you for what you've shared. Obviously, what the Academy work does in policies and other things, even like things that matter in this environment, and not just today, but tomorrow, like climate change and some of the other things you're advocating for. It's clear that the Academy has an important role in this country especially, and probably overseas as well. So thank you for the work that you and your team do every day, and thank you for sharing your knowledge.
Thanks, Sammy. It's a delight to be here.
Hi, this is Tammy again. When I'm not doing podcasts, I'm helping not-for-profits with IT decisions. The question for this week's IT in Plain English segment is, what is a VPN? A VPN, or a virtual private network, is a type of software that allows you to securely connect to the internet by creating a private encrypted connection between your computer and the internet. A lot of organizations deployed these solutions during the COVID lockdowns to allow staff working from home to access their on-premise systems. However, with the increasing use of third-party cloud software, many users no longer need to use a VPN to access these systems. Yet, doing so while using a public Wi-Fi, such as in cafes or airports, is actually a high cybersecurity risk. So make sure you have the appropriate staff training and IT policies in place to enforce a VPN's usage. And while VPNs can still be hacked, it does require significant effort for an intruder to do so. Therefore, it's still a strong cybersecurity risk mitigation for staff working remotely. So there you have it, in plain English. If you have an IT question you want answered, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn and send me a message. I just might answer it on the show. And if you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave me a review. To all of you executives with a cause, thank you for what you and your staff do every day.